Off the Ball Daily,
a home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
Mick McCarthy.
What? Here
I'm
we go.
Typing on my Google Doc saying Morata is right. I didn't think he played in the Prem. Yes.
The point's been declared.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Off the Ball's Breakfast Bite, a bite-sized serving of Ireland's breakfast sports show.
We'll have Quinny in just a second, but first here is what Ireland's interim head coach Simon Easterby had to say about that loss to France on Saturday afternoon.
You don't want to reflect on those things which maybe, like I say, we didn't defend well enough in our 22, but there's certain things that happen in a game in an instance like that which are going to prevent someone from potentially making a tackle and being in a position to try and stop that. All teams try and do it to a point where they try and create a bit of space through the ruck, and that allows the next person to pick. I guess it's just the judge of whether that contact on Pete was close enough to the ruck for them to feel like it was legal, which is probably about, you know, 3 or 4 metres from the ruck. So, you know, that's something that we'll reflect on and feedback to Angus Gardner and you know, his assistant referees, and obviously the TMO came in and felt like it was legal. I don't know about that. I just, you know, like I said, I think we were down a man, and they probably got themselves into a position where they took advantage of that 15 against 14. We had it in the first half as well, where we conceded a yellow card. You know, Calvin's one is just, it happens. It could have easily just gone as a rugby collision, and it could easily have not resulted in a yellow card. But I think Pete, the incident with Pete happens in the same set of phases, so that, you know, that's not reflective of that try based on being down to 14 men. But yeah, we certainly felt like we didn't take our opportunities. We didn't put them under enough pressure, and when we did, you know, it wasn't until the last sort of 10 minutes of the game where we showed that we could score a decent number of points, but, you know, the game was gone by then.
Game was well gone by then. Alan Quinlan's with us. What happened? What do you think happened?
I just think that the power, their ruck speed and obviously their pace was really significant, and then defensively they were outstanding as well, and that showed from right at the start of the game, where Ireland started the game very well and couldn't break them down. Defensively very strong, organised. At times early on the championship they were quite narrow on defence and shooting out of the line. They were very, very well organised. I think you always remember Sean Edwards after that game in Marseille last year. He was really frustrated, angry, upset with the way they defended in Marseille. Now, Ireland were very good in their attack and their evasion and shape and all that kind of stuff, and they caused France a lot of problems. But yeah, they got it right defensively, and then they have big athletes and really good X-factor players like Biel Barry, who was, and Penaud, the two wingers, really did a lot of damage. But Ireland were kind of shell-shocked a little bit if they'd got a couple of scores early on. And in fairness, the feeling is with DuPont off and Sheehan scores after half-time that France would possibly drop the heads a little bit and Ireland would kick on. That was the expectation, but they reacted very, very quickly again. Very small moments in all the tries, you know. Caelan Doris, the penalty in the build-up to that try, the counter-ruck for Biel Barry's when Ramos puts in a little grubber up the touchline out of their defensive 22.
That
was sloppy out of Ireland. They were too high. Very good out of France. And then the reaction is lent to the field.
That counter-ruck it felt like, certainly retrospectively, but at the moment, it felt, ooh. They kind of blew us off the ball there and went the length of the pitch and scored in the far corner. It was like 70, 80 yards.
Well, it's not very French-like in a sense that, not that they don't counter-ruck. I'm not saying they don't counter up,
but it's so organised and targeted.
So competitive at every moment.
Let's set the scene for what's coming at Cheltenham. John Duggan, good morning to you.
Ger and Colm, how are we doing? Good morning.
Yeah, we're pretty good. What's it like over there?
It's very quiet. It's calm before the storm, folks. Right behind me is the winning post for Cheltenham 2025. And in about a day and a half, about 1 o'clock tomorrow, it will be very much a different picture. It'll be heaving here when there'll be over 60,000 people here for day one of the festival. So, look, we can't wait. It's the day and days of the week when, you know, the racing game is the front pages and the back pages. It's the pinnacle of the sport from a national hunt point of view. And look, we're looking forward to four good days and lots of good storylines.
Yeah, tell us about some of the main storylines that we should be tuning into over the next 4.5 days.
Well, I suppose the saddest thing, obviously, is the Michael O'Sullivan situation, Ger. You know, we know he passed away last month after a battle following that fall at Thurles. And look, there's this huge shock, there's devastation, there's a tremendous amount of grief. The race course have done a very honourable thing in renaming the race he won a couple of years ago, Marine Nationale, the Supreme Novices Hurdle. They're going to call it the Michael O'Sullivan Supreme Novices Hurdle this year. That's the first race of the festival, the first of 28 races tomorrow at 1:20. And racing does go on. It will continue, but that doesn't in any way lessen the devastation and the disbelief and the shock and the grief that everybody's going to be feeling in the weigh room and beyond in the sport. Michael was loved. He was really popular, and he was really going places. He had everything in front of him, and it's just, it's hard to get your head around. It is a dangerous sport. We have had fatalities in the past, but they tend to only happen once in a generation, and it's just so devastating and sad that that Michael is gone. And I think that'll be really the probably the story of the festival is the sadness around that. From an equine point of view, Ger, Galopin des Champs is bidding to become only the fifth horse in history to win the Cheltenham Gold Cup. I was here on Thursday for the official preview night speaking to AP McCoy and Barry Garrity and Jane Mangan. And there's a Hall of Fame area here where they have on boards all of the Gold Cup winners' silks. So you see 101 years of Gold Cup winners and only four horses before. Golden Miller, Cottage Rake, Arkland Bestmate have won three Gold Cups and Galopin des Champs trained by William Mullins. Danny Carlo is bidding to do that on Friday, and he's been a brilliant chaser. Jay McManus has never won a champion chase. He has got John Bond, the favourite, for that on Wednesday. And then tomorrow we have Constitution Hill, who was once owned by Barry Garrity and was in, Barry was telling the story about his kids getting on the horse when he was a very young horse in Meath. Then the horse is sold to England. And he's never been beaten under rules. 10 wins from 10. He won the race a couple of years ago. Has had a few issues, which Nicky Henderson's yard was out of form last year, so he didn't run in the race last year. State Man won the race. So Constitution Hill is there to try and win it again. With brighter days ahead, the mare, trained in Meath by Gordon Elliott and to be ridden by Jack Kennedy, now recovering from injury. And that'll be really exciting. Probably a match tomorrow in the champion hurdle. So when you're talking about the experience here, 280,000 people here after COVID, only 230,000 here last year. There's a cost of living crisis over here in the UK. Tickets are over £100. A pint of Guinness is £7.80 and accommodation is expensive. So you are getting these stories of people going to Spain to go and watch Cheltenham now. I don't know about you guys, whether you'll be where you'll be watching it, but I think Cheltenham can be a state of mind just as much as being here.
That is interesting. And is that beginning to filter into the organisers and how they're perceived? Is it, or is Cheltenham a little bit recession-proof?
No, it is definitely filtering in, because when you think, if you're taking, 50,000 punters off the bottom line in 4 days, that is a huge impact on the jockey club over here, and it's their jewel in the crown. They've got a new guy to run it here. His name is Guy Lavender. He used to run the MCC English Cricket, running Lords, and now he's coming here to run Cheltenham. So I think they're all very aware, and they've been getting out in front of the PR around this about, look, we want the experience to be better. We want people to have a bit more space. We want people to really enjoy themselves. And we want to tackle the maybe affordability issues that you have. But it is a long 4 days, and it does cost a lot of money to stay here and to get here. And if you're coming over from Ireland. And another thing as well, I think a big narrative has changed here. I've been coming here 23 years now. When I started coming here, Ireland had five winners the first year. And Barry Garrity would be bringing in a tricolour on Moscow Flyer. And that'll be a case for many years because of the Anglo-Irish thing. It'll be the underdog thing. And an Irish winner will be very much celebrated. The last 3 years, we've had 18 winners the last 3 years. Willie Mullins has been very, very dominant in terms of the big races and had 103 winners now at the festival. So the Anglo-Irish thing has changed. And maybe for the kind of romantic stories are no longer there. Tom Foley had never been on a plane before Donoghue went and won here in 1994. And you're hoping for a few of those stories, but they're less and less.
To listen to this morning's full Off The Ball breakfast, become a member at offtheball.com/join now.